If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First of all, it's free, which for us is really important. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Emergency Docs. I'm Dr. R. Please keep in mind that the content of this episode does not constitute medical advice, but is purely for the purpose of education. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. Today, we're talking to Dr. Arthur Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan is a professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City. Prior to coming to NYU, Dr. Kaplan was the Sidney D. Kaplan Professor of Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he created the Center for Bioethics and the Department of Medical Ethics. He has also taught at the University of Minnesota, the University of Pittsburgh, and Columbia University, and received his PhD from Columbia University. Dr. Kaplan is the author or editor of 35 books and more than 800 papers in peer-reviewed journals. His most recent books are Vaccination Ethics and Policy and Getting to Good, Research Integrity in Biomedicine. So with that, welcome Dr. Kaplan.
Thanks very much. I have to laugh. I think I've added about 30 articles in the peer-reviewed journals just due to COVID over the past 9 months.
I can imagine. There's no shortage of biomedical ethical questions.
Right, just huge.
So let's kind of just start with the basics. What do you do as a biomedical ethicist?
So I run a division, NYU Grossman School of Medicine. I'm the chief of the division, and we have a number of areas where we do work. We teach required courses to our med students. We have a master's program in bioethics that recruits both doctors, lawyers, and other people with other backgrounds, some on their way to medical school, some on their way to law school, some on their way to social work school. Probably have about 20 students at any given time in there. We teach them. We have research projects. We're a very busy research program in that we do surveys, we do analyses of opinion leaders, we try to see using decision theory how docs make decisions about things like ivermectin. Have a study on that going on now. And we might do research on using legal analysis or even history. So projects are ongoing in vaccines, which, by the way, I started at the University of Pennsylvania probably 10 years ago, long before COVID, but it's positioned us to be knowledgeable about what goes on with vaccines. We have projects on rationing, early approval of medicines, how you gain access to expanded access and compassionate use drugs and vaccines, which came up again, ironically, with emergency use approval, reproductive technologies, big footprint in transplant ethics. So many, many papers, many, many reports. We sometimes get involved in issuing guidelines. Listeners may be interested to know we just started a project literally this week on boosters, trying to get some guidance out about, are they really boosters? Are they third shots? Are you taking away from other people if you use third shot for yourself? How do we handle distribution? And many, many other questions like that. And then lastly, we do get involved in policy advice. So Department of Health, the city of New York will use us, state of Connecticut will use us. And that's been true, particularly in COVID, for allocation, rationing, many, many decision mandates, many decisions that policymakers have to face. So it's busy, very active. We occasionally do one more thing I'll mention. We do case consults. So if there is a battle in the hospitals that NYU has, and it's a huge system now, stretching from Long Island through Brooklyn into Bellevue and the VA and the Tisch Hospital in Manhattan, up into Westchester County, say a family is fighting about ending food and water for a particularly ill loved one, they can't agree. That's the sort of thing we get called in to help mediate. So we have a clinical presence And that can be lively sometimes.
I've been involved with a few of those cases, and I think it's always a really valuable asset to have a bioethicist involved and really helping guide some of the ethics of those decisions. Because I think a lot of family members feel a lot of guilt about making those decisions, and they don't want to, you know, quote, give up. And so really discussing some of the ethics of, are we doing harm? Are we making this person's end of life more difficult than it needs to be, and sort of going through those discussions, I think are very, very valuable.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we've done some good being able to mediate some difficult cases and get them resolved. But I will confess, it doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes the family still resists and has their path that they want to follow on religious grounds or cultural grounds or whatever it might be. So I can't say we succeed all the time, but I think many times it can be helpful.
So you've founded several departments, medical ethics. So what inspired you to study biomedical ethics?
Well, there's a sort of deep Freudian answer to that, and then a more practical answer. The deep Freudian one is when I was about six, I had polio. And I was in the hospital for 9 months at the Mass General. I'm from Framingham outside of Boston. And the only word people say that reveals I'm from Boston is when I say Boston. But anyway, so I was in there paralyzed. My legs were paralyzed, my neck. I did not have any complications with my diaphragm or muscles in the ribs or anything like that. So I could breathe. I never was in an iron lung. But many people around me were, many of them kids, and many died. It got me thinking, even at that very, very young age, they don't tell us the truth. They'd say, you know, Johnny went home, and you're sort of like, Johnny didn't go home. Johnny was dying next to me. I doubt very much that he went home. Even at six, you're sort of like, this doesn't square up. And I can tell you my memories of that are very almost photograph type. I remember them well.
Yeah.
Couldn't see your parents, your family, limited visiting hours at that time. They didn't have people stay in the hospital, which we often do today. I didn't think I saw my dog for a year, which drove me crazy. And then I got involved in rehab because, for reasons unknown to science, the virus began to be killed in my body and I began to get function back. But I'd been in bed so long that I had a lot of muscle weakness. I had to learn to walk again. So that was 2 years roughly more of PT. And I learned about rehab medicine. I probably am the only ethicist today that writes about rehab medicine. It's not glamorous. It doesn't have a big technology. People sort of forget about it, but it's obviously very important in orthopedics and stroke in many, many areas where you have to be rehab. So that got me interested. The more immediate trigger, not to take up the whole program with my biography, but when I went to college at Brandeis, I was very interested in ethics because I took some philosophy courses. And at the time, there were all kinds of issues breaking about the Vietnam War and feminism and gay rights, all civil rights, lots of issues just on campus and being debated. And I got engaged with all that. So I decided to head off to med school and I went to Columbia. And when I was there in the first year, I began to see different issues happening in front of me. For example, we were an early program to try and do in vitro fertilization, but it was very controversial. And the head of OBGYN at the time did not want any in vitro fertilization experiments done. And he actually went into the lab of one of the guys that was doing that work and flushed it down the drain, whatever was in those dishes.
Wow.
And I wasn't there to see it, but I certainly heard about it. And I began to ask our medical school dean, when do we talk about these ethics issues? And the dean said, well, you ask your attendings. For those of you not familiar with medical hierarchy, the chance of a first-year student asking his attending about a medical ethics issue was somewhere between zero and a big minus number. That wasn't going to happen. I just did what they said, and that was about that. But I decided to go down to Columbia and get a philosophy degree and study the ethics issues and then try to bring it back to medicine. So that was the more immediate road. And it's probably more than you needed to hear, but it's kind of interesting.
That's fascinating. I mean, and I think you bring up a really good point in that biomedical ethics is actually incredibly undertaught in medical school. The only formal course that I took was actually when I was an undergraduate and I was required to take a philosophy credit. So I took biomedical ethics.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's really all of the formal education that I have beyond sort of like the day-to-day education as you learn to become a physician. So I'm very grateful you're doing what you're doing.
So I will tell you, we have required courses in first and second year, and they're fine. And we do more clinical discussion in the second year. First year's a little didactic. But the toughest challenge for me, and my program has probably, I don't know, 6 professors, maybe 8 postdocs, a variety of other med students and people hanging around. But the biggest challenge is residents. That's where the action is. And they're scattered all over the place. And listeners, again, may not realize, you know, just using the NYU system, we have 1,000 residents in a zillion departments scattered over a geographic space that's probably end to end, at least 200 miles. Getting in front of them, getting there when they have the cases, getting there when they're responsible for decisions is very, very tough. It's like we do some, I'm not saying we don't do it, but I don't think we do enough. And that's the area I'm probably most challenged by and would like to see improved. It's great to talk in the classroom, and you'll remember this yourself. You know, what you think in the first and second year about what's going on is interesting, but really it's what happens when you're out there taking care of patients that it gets really interesting. And the attending says, don't call me tonight unless you really have, you know, the world's biggest crisis. And you got to make decisions, and you're kind of trying to figure out what to do.
It's very much a culture, I think, of learning on the fly in some cases. But I feel fortunate that I took that course when I did, because it sort of just gave me a framework as I went into medical school and residency to work from. But I mean, there's been no shortage of topics in biomedical ethics over the last 2 years, particularly related to COVID. So let's kind of start at the beginning, the pandemic, and there was a lot of buzz around hydroxychloroquine as a cure for COVID or preventative medication for COVID, along with bleach and a bunch of other things. And so I think people were just scared and desperate and prescribing medications inappropriately. So can you talk about the ethics surrounding the issue of prescribing medications for off-label use, and how doctors should approach deciding whether to prescribe a medication off-label?
So let's even add into that mix ivermectin, the deworming medicine.
Yep.
That was developed really for guinea worm in Africa and used very successfully. Merck did it. Merck also realized if you could kill worms in people, you could kill worms in animals. And so they built a big division for veterinary medicine using ivermectin, and they didn't really see a use anywhere else. So the manufacturer has said, Merck, this is for animals only. It's dosed for horses and sheep, and listeners may not realize, dogs. It's the main ingredient of your deworming heartworm pill. And your, if you have a dog, I'm not sure it's used in cats. I don't have cats, but I have dogs, and I know it's used there for sure. Anyway, so there is a huge push. I'm not even sure who started it, to use ivermectin both prophylactically and therapeutically for COVID. There was a paper that came out of France that said ivermectin seems to help prophylactically. It has been withdrawn as completely incoherent. I don't even know how it got into a journal, but anyway, it was challenged and it's been retracted, as they say. Therapeutically, I haven't seen any data, any substantiated claim that anybody got better who was dying from COVID and somebody gave them ivermectin and they were either stabilized or got better. I've seen nothing. There are anecdotes, people claiming something. So still a lot of people ask for ivermectin. And my view is this. Legally, you can use anything that's out there off-label. You are free to prescribe it. We have a very generous legal backdrop. Once FDA approves a drug, you may use it off-label. It's important to remember, ivermectin is not approved by FDA for human use, at least outside of a narrow indication for worms. Maybe it might be used for a tapeworm, I don't know. But it's certainly not approved, and there's no indication for it for any viral disease, including COVID. Second, the science doesn't square up here. Why would ivermectin, a deworming parasite pill medicine, kill the virus? Doesn't make any sense. So, could you use it? Yes, you do have discretion to prescribe, but you are way outside the label indication. So, legally, your liability is if something goes wrong, you are responsible and you could be sued even if the patient requested it. It's not up to what the patient said. It's up to what you did. By the way, this is true for any off-label use of anything. You can do it, but if harm happens, you are responsible. And I can tell you, I've testified, not a lot, but a few times in malpractice suits, basically for off-label use of a device or a drug. And I'm just going to say flat out, you will lose. I mean, there is no defense. Person got injured, you're off-label. They turn around and basically it's a how much are you going to pay to their insurance company, or some of them are self-insured, so it's how much are you paying? Ethically, my view is, whatever the off-label, you've got to resist it. I don't even care if there's a court order. I would not fill a prescription for a dangerous non-indicated drug that the manufacturer says don't use, that WHO says don't use, that the AMA says don't use. In other words, the standard of care says don't use it. And I don't really care what a judge says. If they want to come in and administer it and prescribe it, let them go to medical school and do it. I don't see it. I know it's risky to defy a court order, and I think they have to be appealed, but I would never fill an off-label request unless I really believed, for whatever reason, that this might help.
Yeah, I think it's really common for patients to come in to a physician, or in my case, an emergency department, with an idea of what they want or what they think they need. And I think our job as clinicians is to really guide them and say, this is what the science supports. This is what the literature supports. This is what my diagnosis is for whatever's going on. And this is the appropriate treatment for that, or there is no appropriate treatment for that. And I think very often I've heard a lot of colleagues, and I've felt pressure from patients to sort of cave into demands that I know are inappropriate. And so I think it's always a good reminder to sort of discuss these issues and remember that we should always be guided by the science, not by any political or personal pressures.
Right. To put it simply, and I think that was well said, medicine should not be practiced like a restaurant. You don't go in and have somebody order something and then say, okay, well, I'll get you that. Sometimes we do it. I see it. People come in and say, the erectile dysfunction area is big for this. I want Viagra. And the doctor should be saying, do you have any other issues? Maybe I have to examine you for diabetes, or maybe you have high blood pressure, or maybe your relationship isn't so good, before I prescribe this medicine that you want because you saw it on TV. And we do have this, what I consider unfortunate, direct-to-consumer advertising going on all the time of products. I have to work you up. I have to examine you. I have to see what the cause might be of your erectile dysfunction or whatever it is. So when the patient comes in and says, I saw on TV that I want this, I think that's a starting point, but that isn't the end point. I think doctors should practice according to what the standard of care is, according to what they know is the evidence base, the latest literature, talking to colleagues to get other opinions. And the fact that the patient appears with a request, I'm almost going to say, is meaningless to me. It doesn't count.
Yeah, I think another interesting ethical issue surrounding patient requests would be the discussion of birth control, because I've also had patients come to me and say, oh, so-and-so doctor refused to prescribe birth control for me, or so-and-so doctor refused to remove my IUD when I asked. And so I think that really gets into discussions of patient autonomy as well, and making sure that in those cases, making sure that we are following the standard of care and not, you know, refusing something based off of a personal belief or a personal issue, I guess.
Yeah, that reminds me of one other small point, but important. If you're putting something into somebody's body, feeding tube, IUD, I don't care what it is, there should always be a discussion about when it's coming out. And that can include never or not until you die or something. But in addition to getting consent to start whatever it is you're going to do, ventilator, intubation, whatever, somebody should have that discussion saying, and if you don't flourish or you don't respond, we're going to discontinue. Or if you decide you want a child, we're going to take it out. And here's the circumstances under which that can be done, and whatever. Starting things really demands some discussion of stopping things. And I think that would get us out from under a lot of fights and misunderstandings and battles that break out.
That's a good point. I do have patients ask if I'm admitting them to the hospital, when am I getting out? And so often, I mean, that's just an I don't know. I can't really predict that kind of.
But I'm all right with that as long as they know.
As long as it's an honest answer, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of situations too many, where the first time somebody talks about the fact that not only you're not getting out, you're going to die when palliative care comes in. Too often the oncologist or whoever it is pushing the next trial or the next something. And they haven't really said, it's very unlikely you're going to benefit here. We want to prepare for a bad outcome. We want to prepare for your death. No one really wants to, well, not no one, but sometimes people aren't willing to go there. And, you know, you got to start that dialogue early so that then you're not at the end of the road and people don't even understand that there's nothing more to do.
Yeah, I think that really sets up problematic expectations. When I was working in the ICU in particular, you know, you see all of these different specialists that come in and see patients, for example, you know, a cancer patient. And so the oncologist is telling the patient, oh, there's this new study we can try. The ICU doctors are coming in and saying, you are going to be miserable, you know, if we continue to try these things. Like, here are some palliative measures we can do to make you more comfortable so you can enjoy as much as possible and have some freedom for the remainder of your life. And then, you know, other specialists coming in and saying other things. So
we just had a case, an individual had severe heart disease, multiple stents, diabetes, had some form of lung cancer going on early stage, and was detected to have pancreatic cancer and underwent a Whipple. This guy isn't going to live a week anyway. And sort of pounding on that person, I thought was almost malpractice. It was like, what are we doing here? But people do feel an obligation to come in and either say, well, I could treat that disease, or yep, I can offer you something.
We have to try something.
We have to try something. And yet at the same time, you know, from the patient's point of view, here is a place of autonomy. They may say, look, you know, if that's what you got and I'm going to be sick, or in the case of this surgery, laid up for my final week, 2 weeks, I'll forego that and I'd rather feel better.
Yeah. I think it's really difficult for families to navigate that information sometimes. I mean, as a physician, it's difficult for me to navigate the medical system as a patient. So, you know, I yeah, can only imagine how difficult it can be for families without any sort of medical training.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about vaccines, because this is another ethical question that I think there's been a huge amount of debate around personal freedoms. And I guess this applies to masks as well. So somebody's personal freedom versus having some sort of personal inconvenience to protect the population as a whole. So how would you encourage our listeners to kind of think about this problem and approach this problem?
So the first issue about autonomy with respect to vaccines or masks is, what's my personal situation? Am I a nursing aide in a nursing home where I deal with very vulnerable people who we know have died in high numbers because of COVID being brought into the institution? Am I working at home? I'm basically just here with someone, let's say, that doesn't also leave the house and works from home, and I have minimal contact unless I go to the supermarket or the store with others. They're not quite in the same zone of risk, if you will, either to get sick or to make others sick. There, one is very likely to expose people, given the high contact, the nurse's aide. They shift frequently from place to place. They can become almost Typhoid Mary-like in some of the spread that they can do. And another person's just home and not really exposing much, not getting exposed and not exposing others very much. So where you are on the scale of risk to yourself, where you are on the scale of risk to others, I think matters. Secondly, vaccines. Exceedingly safe, work very well. I see people sometimes say, what about heart problems, heart inflammation? The rate of heart inflammation from COVID is about 10 to 20 times what is alleged to come from vaccines. I'm not even sure it does come from vaccines, because the people who have heart inflammation weren't tested for COVID before they detected the heart inflammation post a vaccination. So it's sort of like, I don't know, but very safe. Don't believe misinformation. A mask is not going to cause your child to have lack of oxygen and brain damage. I keep seeing that sort of stuff up on the internet. If you're a doctor, be important to know, what are people afraid of? Look at the social media. Be ready to answer questions. I might even probe a bit. Are you worried about vaccines because you think they have chips in them? Are you worried about vaccines because you think they contain fetal cells, whatever. Know what they're fearful about, and that will help get compliance. So having said all that, I'm a big proponent of the following principle. Don't kill your neighbor. I think that's the Trump principle, not Donald Trump, but the one that triumphs over my body or my control. You should not do things that harm others. You have freedom only to the point where you're not causing harm to others. I can't pick which side of the road I want to drive on. I should put my child in a car seat. I cannot appear, let's say, to want to drive drunk or to speed at any rate I want. There are many walks of life, in other words, where we limit freedom. Limiting freedom and saying you can't kill everybody, you can't kill people you come in contact with, you can't put nursing home residents at grave risk. You can see where I'm going. I favor mandatory vaccination. I favor mandatory masking. Neither of which I think are dangerous. Neither of which I think are undue burdens. I don't like wearing a mask myself, but it's not the worst thing that happens to me in a day. What I would really prefer is improved traffic flow on the New York area. But so I think there is a case, morally, strong case, to say, particularly for those in high contact work, teachers, nurses aides, doctors, EMTs, the state police, people who work at big box stores, people who are trying to staff restaurants and groceries. And by the time you get done with it, it may be a tiny handful of people who can make the case that they're staying home and they're not going anywhere and their food is delivered. And maybe I could say, all right, maybe you could wave out of a mask or a vaccine requirement. But, you know, my bottom line is they're safe. They're easy. I just got my third shot. I just got my flu shot at the same time. I'm here. I'm talking to you. I was not turned into an alien being or anything. They work. They're easy. Don't whine about them. Follow the principle of care for your neighbor. And if you're a healthcare professional, follow the principle, do no harm. And every code of ethics in healthcare says patients first. It doesn't say I get to do what I want. I was talking with a cop the other day, a state policeman here in Connecticut, who wasn't sure about vaccination, said, I have the right to do what I want. And I turned around and I looked at his police car. And what does it say on the door? Protect and serve. It doesn't say, I'm a policeman. I'm going to do what I want. So let's use our heroic altruistic motives, help others, protect others, serve others. That's the principles I want to hear about.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I appreciate the freedoms and autonomy that we have living in the United States, but I think we also need to still consider our neighbors and make sure that we aren't doing harm to others because of our need for our own personal freedoms. I think that's kind of where the line for me is drawn.
Right, the classic philosophers, Mill, John Stuart Mill out of England, back in the 19th century said, roughly paraphrasing, you're free, free to do what you want, but your freedom to swing your arm ends at the tip of the next guy's nose. If you punch him, then you're not free to do it.
So if someone has a family member or a patient who is really questioning masks and vaccines, what do you think is the best way to approach them, particularly given the plethora of vaccine misinformation that's out there?
I think the best way to approach them is to stay 6 feet away when you're and put on a mask, but that's how we approach them. But yeah. I know what you mean. To talk with them, I think we have to say, look, here's the facts about vaccine safety. Here's the real truth about vaccine efficacy. These vaccines, I'll give credit, particularly Pfizer, particularly Moderna, extraordinarily effective. Again, you know, hitting rates like 90% efficacy, even though we've seen breakthrough cases, you don't die, you don't get as sick, and you really are less infectious, they work very well. They're better than measles vaccine and flu vaccine. These are good. Safety profiles, amazingly good. The newer technology really reduces allergic reactions. And don't worry about long-term effects because the agents that are in there to sort of trigger the creation of a spike protein to intercept viruses, the body eventually clears them out after a year or two. That's why we have to talk about boosters or further vaccination. So there aren't any long-term side effects. This is not going to stay in your body. figure out what they're worried about, address the safety, try to get rid of the misconceptions they picked up from the neighbors or the internet or wherever. I would even say familiarize yourself with what those false messages might be. Helps the conversation to know what they might be embarrassed to tell you that they're thinking about. They're worried that there's a chip in the vaccine and they're going to be tracked, that kind of fear. And the other thing I do is I now start to say, look, here's the data. You want to look at the places that vaccinate. They're probably 20% death rates compared to what's going on where people aren't vaccinating. And the numbers tell you the story. You really want to protect yourself. You want to protect your family members. Look at the data. It's pretty clear.
Thinking about vaccination in general, like, you're an example of what a difference the polio vaccine has made in our life. You know, you may be the first person I've met who had polio, actually. And I mean, that's just evidence on how fantastic vaccines can be in getting rid of some of these terrible diseases.
So I have something mean to say, though, in that regard. WHO, many groups are saying we must vaccinate the world. And we do need to vaccinate the world, not just the neighbor or people in our county, because we owe it to them to save their lives. And as long as there are big populations out there unvaccinated, there's always the possibility of increasing more dangerous mutations. We've seen COVID strains here that are easier to catch. Hopefully we won't get one that's more virulent or nasty or more lethal to us. But the way to control that is to tamp down the ability of the virus to mutate by being in fewer people to kind of incubate it. All that said, there's been a campaign to eradicate polio around the world. Do you know when it started?
It's been like, what, 60, 50, 70 years?
50 years, probably the biggest push, I'll give him credit, 1998, maybe you could say 25, to really drive it. It's been led by the Gates Foundation.
Yep.
Rotary International adopted it as a cause. WHO is on there. UNICEF is on there. For those who don't know, the polio vaccine is relatively easy because it's oral. You don't have to go around with needles and adjuvants and refrigerators. Heavy-duty refrigerators. It's pretty easy to move it to a village, give it to the kids, line them up. And the campaign was done, you'll like this. There's no informed consent. There's nobody declining. When they hit a village, it's line up the kids and off we go. There's no risk discussion or maybe this would give you polio. For some of them, there's a teeny risk that could have. Anyway, my point is to vaccinate the world and eliminate polio, which we're pretty close, not there, but it's taken, if you want to be generous, 25 years. We're not going to vaccinate against COVID around the world in a year.
Yeah.
Even if we made a ton of vaccine, you got to distribute it. They need the infrastructure. Got to teach people to deliver it. It's rigmarole on a big scale. So you have to remember polio is easier, in my view, to do. Just getting around the world to remote areas and remote villages and places that don't have roads. It's quite a task.
I've read a little bit about the issues with the polio vaccination and the reason that it's not eradicated yet. And there's still a lot of that mistrust where people have associated that vaccine with causing infertility incorrectly. Yep. And I think a lot of that potentially has to do with the lack of informed consent and sort of not having that risks and benefits discussion.
Yes.
And that breeds mistrust.
And by the way, their 25 years of not doing consent and not really tolerating refusals, that is not the world today. The world reads the same internet we do. If you go out there now with COVID vaccines, you're going to get more resistance. You're going to encounter more hesitancy. It's not the same world as it was, I'm going to say, back then. So I'm not saying don't vaccinate the world. I'm just saying you got to be realistic here. COVID's going to be with us for a while.
Yeah.
Years.
Yes.
Years. It is not going away because we vaccinated the world in a year.
I mean, my suspicion is that we're going to end up sort of with annual mutations and probably annual booster shots. And maybe we'll get it under control eventually and, you know, figure out how to get rid of it on a more permanent basis. But I highly doubt that, you know, based on what we're seeing.
I think it's going to drop down to flu levels. You get that. Maybe we'll come up with a pill like we have for HIV that could treat the infected and they won't die at the same rates. But I want listeners to understand you've got a nasty little virus that is easy to transmit. It's highly contagious relative to other things that are out there that we worry about a lot. And it is not going to be gone. It's going to have to be controlled. It's going to have to be something we can live with.
So I've heard about cases of individuals with non-COVID illness who have not been able to get good medical care because of the overload of unvaccinated COVID patients in hospitals. And so as a physician, to me, this is a pretty big ethical quandary. You know, I want to help everyone, but at the same time, I question, is it right, you know, if a person is in a hospital because of an intentional choice that they made not to be vaccinated, is now ill and takes a bed from another person who has a non-COVID illness that couldn't have been prevented. So how do you approach this from an ethical viewpoint?
Yeah, this is an entire course.
Yeah.
Because again, there are different settings. Let me start you with one setting that I work in. Remember I mentioned we do transplant ethics a lot and study it?
Yep.
So here's a question. Do you have to be vaccinated to be on the transplant wait list?
Oh, my assumption would be yes, but I don't know for sure.
So it wasn't policy. Some centers are moving in that direction, but it's not yet become the standard of care or the national standard. So I think it should be.
That's interesting. I mean, to get a transplant, I feel like particularly for like liver transplants, you have to prove that you aren't drinking, that you aren't doing any of these like destructive behaviors.
Correct.
Yeah, that's really, it's an interesting
question. A lot of the cardiac programs say no smoking. By the way, a lot of the orthopedic programs, if you want to get a knee or a hip replacement, say no smoking, no drinking, not because what they're worried about is falls. And they have other, you know, criteria for getting, it's not like we don't have standards in many areas for access to the service. So in any event, and by the way, one other weird question, if you get a donor, should they have been vaccinated? Or would you take an organ from an unvaccinated person and give it with a consent, saying maybe this lung or this kidney has virus or the blood that will undoubtedly be around? Anyway, so... And just to show you, it's always complicated in ethics. That's just one little area, how to manage status of vaccination vis-a-vis access to service. A second one I'll mention is primary care. So there are doctors, and they've talked to me, and they say, I'm a family physician, or I'm an OBGYN, or I'm a pediatrician, and I'm not taking people who aren't vaccinated. I don't want new patients who aren't vaccinated. And some of them are just mad that people aren't vaccinated. Some of them are sort of saying, look, if you won't follow my advice about this, then I have no reason to think you're going to follow my advice about anything, so I can't work with you. Some are saying, I don't want to be exposed. I don't want my staff exposed. I don't want the waiting room exposed. So you can't come here unless you're vaccinated. Listeners may need a reminder. We have no duty to care for anybody as a patient, with one exception, the emergency room. there is a federal law that says you got to take all comers and stabilize them. But in a private practice, group practice, in a clinic, I show up and say, I want to become a patient here. And they can say, we don't take Medicaid. I don't like the way you behave. I think you're going to be non-compliant, whatever. There's no right. So these doctors legally can do what they're doing. Morally, I think it's okay to do it, but I would insist that you continue to try to push them to vaccinate, get their name and number and hector them and say, you know, don't want to go without care. And the way to do it is to vaccinate. So let's do it. Then we come to your issue. What about with the ventilators, with dialysis? Usually in the ER, ethically, you can't sort them out because of that federal law I mentioned. And people sort of do all comers, drunks, people who tried to kill themselves, suicides. I mean, that's sort of a morally culpable, if you want to get into blame. We got people who OD on things. We got, well, you know as well as I do, in emergency medicine, you're taking everybody. And a lot of bad behavior could be on display, child abuse and nasty things. And I support that. I think we should, you know, the easiest ethic is to take all comers. It's often hard and time is limited. You're not going to really know why this person didn't vaccinate. Maybe they didn't vaccinate because they couldn't get to a vaccine center because they have 3 kids and 4 jobs. I don't know. It might not have been a choice. It might have been a limited access. In any event, It gets to be more interesting when you refer him into the ICU. The ER sends him on, and we have access to beds, maybe pulmonary equipment, ventilators, and so on, intubation. And then in our system, I saw dialysis come up frequently as short. Not enough techs, people needing that as well. So what I would say there is this. I think you can make a decision to not continue care with somebody who's unvaccinated with COVID out of control because it gives you a prognosis that they're not going to do well. Vis-a-vis someone who's in there from a heart attack or something we know that we could fix. So I wouldn't use COVID status just to say, sorry, you're not getting in the ICU. But I would use it as a guide to rationing resources when it becomes relevant to efficacy. I would do the same for other conditions. I mean, somebody says you have 9 comorbidities and you're, 85 years old versus you're 40 and had a heart attack. If you're short, I think you got to sort of do where you're going to have the best chance to do good. So it's a long-winded answer, but remember, different settings. I want a transplant. I'm trying to decide if you'll be my pediatrician, what happens in the ER, then what happens in the ICU and beyond. Weirdly, one area where we take the whole show up with this, but I warned you, it could take a course here. Even access to palliative care, people were saying they're not vaccinated, they're dying, I'm not going in the room, right? So you get into, is the chaplain going in to the unvaccinated dying person's room? Do we have to go in moon suits and sort of ask for that because they're burdening us? Because they, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's no shortage of questions to ask, and it's such a difficult issue. And fortunately, it hasn't really been a problem as far as rationing care in my hospital, but I've read story after story about, people who have faced these sorts of dilemmas. And, I can't imagine what I would do in those situations because I haven't been in it yet. But it's an interesting problem to consider. Do you have any advice about what primary ethical principles should sort of govern our society in times of crisis, like during a pandemic?
Yeah, I do. I think the first principle of a pandemic is, as I keep saying, prevent harm, prevent death, prevent vulnerable individuals in particular from dying from whatever the pandemic might be. It doesn't really matter whether it's Ebola or COVID or Zika or cholera, whatever it is. Second, try to prevent the spread. So it is very important that you try to contain outbreaks as best you can. We're obviously doing a lot of yelling at China. Did they contain quickly? What did they know? When did they know it? I'll say I don't think we're ever going to get the answer to that because they're not being cooperative. But there is a duty to try and contain an outbreak as best you can. We did that with Ebola. Tried very hard to, if you will, rings were built around outbreak sites, medicines delivered to try and control Ebola by keeping it inside a particular area and so on. That's good practice. I think another one is care for your neighbor. Try to be attentive to their needs. There are many people out there, people with immune diseases, newborn babies, people who have cancer and have immune system suppression or transplants. Protect them. They're very vulnerable. We have to worry about what's going on with your neighbor or the elderly. I think it's a good principle for society to follow that we don't do it enough in general life, but it becomes very important in pandemic. And then I would say another key moral principle is try to use the least invasive and coercive intervention when you're trying to get people to do the right thing, like mask or vaccinate. But if they don't do it, don't be afraid to move on to a more consistent and more, let's say, coercive type intervention. You have to yield your liberty if we're going to see harm reduced. But we did it in this country. We tried to get people by persuasion. We moved to incentives, win a prize, get free meals, get free joints, marijuana in the state of Washington. If you vaccinate, we were trying to incentivize. Here's a $100 card. We had that in New York to get a vaccine. Didn't work enough. Then it's time to bring in the hammer.
So I know I need to let you go. I just had one more question about sort of bad behavior during the pandemic. We've seen a ton of it, from people hoarding toilet paper to peddling misinformation to, I mean, I've been accused of violating the Hippocratic Oath by people because I have advocated for vaccinations.
Right. By the way, me too. Yeah.
I've like driven past emergency departments where people are protesting out front and their kids are falling out of the strollers and rolling into the streets because they're too busy protesting to look at what's going on around them. So what do you think we can learn from all of this bad behavior during this pandemic? And is there anything that you think we can do to prevent it or, you know, get to a better place in case of future international crises?
Yeah. So let me start with something that you asked about earlier. If you're not vaccinated, can you be excluded or given lower priority? And I said only if it impacts efficacy, only if it impacts the chance of success when you're inside the hospital system. But if you harass, threaten, or literally physically harm healthcare workers, I think you can be excluded. That is not acceptable. And we should draw that line and make it clear. You harass me, you blockade me from entry, you touch me, you throw things at me, you go to my house and scare my kids. If I know who you are, I will not care for you. Don't do it. It's a violation of the doctor-patient ethic. Even within the hospital, somebody jumps up and starts beating up people, pulls a gun. I'm not saying, you know, we can't treat people when they're restrained. I'm not saying we can't treat people with a guard present, but that's the kind of thing I would be moving to. So let's limit what kind of baloney we're going to put up with from protesters and critics. It's not, they can protest, but that's it. They can't physically harm. They should not be allowed to intimidate. And I want more administrators to speak up about that, basically saying, we'll protect you. Second, I would say, as a moral message about plagues, misinformation matters. But what's happened in our time is we now have the internet, and it is the world's most gigantic megaphone. It used to be in the old days, some nut would sit next to you at a bar and say, you know what, I think these vaccines are made by communists who are trying to take over our minds. And you would say, okay, give me another beer.
Cheers.
Now that nut is leading a movement. He's got 3,000 followers, and people are reading the same stupid claims. I think the internet has to be policed better for misinformation in a pandemic. People say, well, we have to respect free speech. No, this is fire in the theater. If it's a plague, you got to start to restrain misinformation. Again, I'm not saying you can't protest, but outright fabrication, lies, can't have it. Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, come on, start policing. Maybe the third, and I could go on, but I'll just give you one more. Let's all be in a situation, hopefully in the future, where we get consistent messaging. Government officials, conservative or liberal, you can't put out changing messages every day. You just can't confuse the public.
All right. Well, any last words before we wrap this up?
Last words. To the healthcare workforce, hang in there. Things are going to get better. Vaccination rates are climbing. Mandates work. We're starting to see it. Tyson Foods, United Airlines saw rates 95%. Mandates are going to help us. Medicine is coming, I think. Antivirals that will help treat people who are sick.
Sounds like it today.
Yeah. And that will also be part of the answer to what we're going to have to do overseas. I don't know about vaccinate the world. That's tough. Provide pills for treatment. We've done it. HIV, we've done it. What works to treat probably is going to turn out to have some preventative impact too. We haven't studied that yet, but I'm optimistic that that's going to help. And I think the other thing that I can say is sort of upbeat to end is people are starting to understand you got to respect your neighbor. I see the demonstrators and I see people featuring the nurse who doesn't want to vaccinate, but that isn't the majority of people. It's a small minority. It makes news. It's people always like the squeaky wheel or the cranky person. I saw it with flu. In healthcare, we had flu mandates. And, you know, you had to get a flu shot. I'm sure you did. I did. To work. So did all those people saying, I don't want a COVID vaccine. By the way, they all had to take flu shots. So what the heck they're talking about that they don't want to vaccinate now is beyond me. But okay. But what I learned from flu shots, and I was an advocate of that mandate and pushed it hard years ago, is that people then come to accept it. It's just something you realize is going to happen if you work in a nursing home, in a home care program, in a hospital, wherever. New employees are going to know you got to do it. Things will get better about that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kaplan. This was a really fascinating discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Appreciate the questions. I should add, by the way, anybody wants to follow me on Twitter, that space that I said was out of control, but I am there. So it's at Arthur Kaplan if you want to.
Awesome. We'll follow you for sure. Is there any other organization or social media account or anything that you would like to tell us about?
I think a good site to follow if you're interested in ethics, both COVID and more broadly, the American Journal of Bioethics has a website that's very good. And the Hastings Center, which is located near me in Connecticut over in near West Point, New York, is a think tank that publishes the Hastings Center report, but also maintains a very useful website for all kinds of ethics questions, not just COVID. And I think they're fun to follow. They're interesting. They're provocative. If you decide you would like your temperature, or excuse me, your blood pressure raised by something other than COVID issues, you can track those sites. You can see a lot of arguing.
All right. We'll definitely have to check those out.
Thank you again.
Okay. Well, that's it. Thank you so much. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, rate, review, or connect with us on Instagram at The Emergency Docs or on our website at theemergencydocs.com. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. Until next time. We'll be right back.